I grew up in a musical family. My father was the head of the classical radio station in Belgium, was also a pretty renowned, well-respected composer, trained as a trompeter at the Concertgebouw National Supérieur in Paris. So that's the world that we grew up in. And I still recall from my father saying, "Oh, do whatever you want, but please don't go into music. It's way too hard." And we ended up all in music. Myself, I was always attracted, we can go into that later, by the more business side or behind the scenes of the music profession. And my brother, David Lings, is an award-winning jazz vocalist who really don't understand why I love so much working behind the scenes and he's on the stage all the time. So that's the contrast. And then we have one sister, Sarah. She plays music, amateur, but she works for a big company, for a big basically beverage company. So that's where we are. I mean, music was always very, very important to us. I've been very, very lucky that there was a lot of classical music, was a lot of jazz music. My father was classical trained, we were classical trained. My father had his own jazz music festival under the umbrella of the Belgian public broadcast station. So that has been, when I look back now, in my early years, that has been extremely, extremely important, because it's not that we were categorized like classical music is good and jazz is bad and pop is even worse. Music was music. And as long as it was done, and it is done in a good way, and that's really also my vision and my opinion, every kind of music has its value as long as it's professionally well done.
In many European countries, the state will support its own broadcast network and will fund music and orchestras and ensembles and many, many, many projects. So that is what your father was working with. That's the
Yes.
system in which he worked. And down the road, you would find things very different, I'm sure, here in the United States. How did you find that contrast
Well,
with?
the contrast is huge. I mean, when I was managing Belgian orchestras, I did a chamber orchestra there, and then also I went to a baroque orchestra in Paris and the Brussels Philharmonic. I mean, we were funded for 85% by the government. I still recall, like, in four chunks, four big checks going in every 3 months. At first sight, you can say this is great. In a way, it is, but it has also a lot of aspects that are not really relevant, that are not really that well, in the sense that when you get so much funding, I'm not saying that I was of that opinion, but when you have so much funding, sometimes you can lose the relevance towards your community. In the sense that I've seen a lot of music directors who basically started programming for themselves, and, "Oh, I love this and I love that." And there was a huge disconnect between the audience and between them. And sometimes, and then I've seen concerts, basically great concerts, amazing concerts with great music, for sometimes nearly empty halls. And then you have to ask yourself, that was only possible then. It was great for the orchestra, it was great for the culture, but the community was not really asking for what certain orchestras were doing. That's one aspect. The other aspect is also that then you get orchestras and orchestras and orchestras and orchestras, and you get so many orchestras that are basically not needed. And then people take it for granted that those orchestras are needed. And then when the government, which is actually happening now, a couple of years started, we say, "Hey, wait a minute. We are so small country, and we end up with 9 or 10 orchestras. There is no real need for that. And now we have a budget problem. Why don't we cut back?" And then everything becomes a huge problem. So that's kind of a little bit the negative aspect. I mean, I've also seen that, and frankly speaking, I mean, also seen that, you have a couple of people that have some influence on the political level. They form a board, they ask for funding, and we always made that joke. I recall, "Okay, let's put a string quartet together, have some influential people, and ask for funding, and we'll probably do well." and I exaggerate a little bit, but that is, it's not on a model. I mean, at first sight, it can be an amazing model. We say, this is great and so much culture and so much fun, and it should be. But over the years, you have seen that there was a slipping away of, you know, what are you actually doing for the community? Now, when I came to the States, it's completely the opposite. I recall I had a position for 8 seasons with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. My annual budget, I mean, I recall my funding from federal, the Commonwealth, and city combined was 2% of my annual budget. So 98% I had to find myself, or let's say 97%, but I had to find it myself. So that's the other. I think that the truth lays somewhere in the middle. I
would think one of the great benefits is access to a young person, to a young child in the culture in Belgium when you grew up. There were so many concerts you could go to. There was media broadcasting this classical music, art music, jazz. So access was there. And in the United States, there are a lot of places that have this kind of access, but there are places that have almost none.
Mm-hmm.
And so some kids are really missing out on their chance to hear orchestras and chamber ensembles. Whereas, you know, when the government funds it, you might hear it much more broadly across a...
And that is completely correct. I mean, but we also must admit that when there was, and I'm talking about 30 years ago, the model was completely different, where there was, one, there was heavy funding, and most of the concerts were basically for free or at very low fees.
Oh, wow.
But that is not the case anymore. So when you compare, I've done that recently, when you compare ticket prices to a concert in the United States and ticket prices to a concert in Europe, it's kind of the same, while that funding is still going on. So that, you know, there is kind of a shift going on there. I also, what I found out by accident a couple of years ago is that whenever big, huge management companies, artist agencies, place an artist in Europe, their fee sometimes is double as high as in the United States of America, because they just, oh yeah, they have the money anyway, so we can ask higher fees. So, I mean, it the model has been, don't get me wrong, it's a great model, but it has been distorted a little bit. And I think what is very important, once again, you have Europe is extreme in funding, then you have United States is extreme on the other side. I think what is great to consider at some point, I don't know it's going to happen soon, but it's that you have that middle where you say, okay, what is your relevance to the community? How many patrons do you have? How many audience members do you reach? What are your education programs? And based on that, government could match what you bring in yourself and cap that. And that, I mean, it's a model that I don't really see in place, but I think it's a great model where you basically are rewarded for what you've done for your community. That is very, very important, I think.
I hope that you will find a community here in West Michigan that considers this orchestra its own. They feel it's their band, and will communicate that by attending concerts, supporting the season, and participating in so much outreach that the symphony provides as well. I think a little later on we're going to have a quick look at the season, which was recently announced and starts in September with a soloist who's from Kalamazoo, Brandon Ridenour, and we might hear a little bit of Brandon a little later this hour. But I wanted to touch on some of the influential points in your life with musicians that you mentioned earlier to me before we went on the air, musicians such as Michel Legrand and Jesse Norman, Placido Domingo, and Marvin Hamlisch. They're all great musicians with incredible careers, true stars, with whom you've formed friendships with.
Yes, I can say that. And it came actually very, very organically. I recall that I mean, I don't personally recall, but I know from my father, when he was in Paris, he used to play in the orchestra of Michel Legrand's father, Raymond Legrand. And my father was a little bit, was a little bit younger than Michel. And he clearly recalls, he still sees Michel at that time. I think my father was 15 or 16 years old, and Michel was about 18, writing all the arrangements for the orchestra of his father. And he was really the protégé of Nadia Boulanger in the Conservatoire of Paris. He studied together. He was really together with Quincy Jones in the class there. They grew up, so Quincy Jones and Michel are still now very, very, very close, very heavy friends. I mean, friends for life. And I've always been impressed by his career. I think he's one of the most interesting and fascinating composers. Composers around, I mean, living composers. I mean, he's 83 now, 84, still writes, plays, tours, I mean, everything. But he went really from classical to jazz. I mean, he made his very first record, international record, I think he was about 18 or 19 years old, with Miles Davis, with Ben Webster, with John Coltrane. I mean, he really got the opportunity to work with them in Paris. That first records became a huge hit, and then other records followed. And he was thrown into that Hollywood world. I mean, he wrote more than 200 film scores, American film scores. But then he also wrote for my previous orchestra, a harp concerto that we premiered 2 months ago. So, I mean, he is really uniquely talented.
One of those musicians who is so hard to define, or won't be defined by a specific genre.
Exactly, and I'm happy that you said it, because it's probably, I'm very sensitive to that, because when in my education there was only music, there was not good music or bad music, so I think there is kind of an identification there, so we're kind of the same platform.
Well, you saw when we first were talking about Legrand, I was not sure. I said, I'm not sure we have any Legrand, because we don't have a strong pops library. And then you said, well, he wrote a concert piece, you know, for the concert hall, harp concerto, and you know, I realized I haven't even scratched the surface of Michel Legrand. And
it's one of his lesser. I mean, it's those works that people don't always play. I mean, he was a great friend of the French trumpeter Maurice André, and he wrote several trumpet concertos for him. You know, he wrote violin concertos. He's currently working on a cello concerto, and he just did. 2 weeks ago, he created a new, complete new ballet for the Opera de Lyon in France. So
let's look at styles. Does he write in a new romantic, accessible?
Oh yeah, style? Yeah. That is exactly. It's neo romantic, accessible style, without becoming corny. You know, which is very difficult.
It is hard.
Yeah, it's very hard, but it's really like, whoa. But you really can see, and now I'm talking as a musician, I'm not talking as an executive director, but when he gave me this score, and especially in the middle part, there is a very slow movement in there, and you hear Ravel. I mean, the way that he divides the strings and he mixes it all up, and you really, through that, you really clearly see all of the orchestration techniques that were taught to him by Nadia Boulanger, because the favorite composer of Nadia Boulanger was not Debussy, it was Ravel. It was Ravel and Stravinsky. And when you have this, I mean, there is one anecdote that I have to tell about Stravinsky, because I asked Michel, did you ever meet Stravinsky? He said, yeah, several times, because what happens is there is a tradition in the Paris Conservatoire that every other month, I think, that the professor invites his or her students at home for a brunch and talking about the arts. And he was sitting there. He said there were several. We had a group, and Jean Cocteau, the writer, was part of that group. Stravinsky was there, and he was very young. He said it was like 13 or 14 years old. And I really have to tell that story, because he told me that was the transformation for him being a classical composer and Nadia Boulanger pushing him to become a classical composer, to becoming a jazz composer, where he said to Stravinsky, "Oh, did you read that analysis of one of your works by?" There was analysis. It was a book that was made, and it was an extremely lively work. And Michel said he brushed it off because, I mean, he was saying like, "Did you read it?" Or yeah, I heard about that book. And then Michel asked him the question, "But what do you think about that analysis of your work?" And I got the biggest lesson in, basically, in music history and music teaching. He said he put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, "My little boy, when you write music, you don't really know what you do." And he said that was life. That was for me. That was like all those rules that I have been taught, they kind of were gone. You know, and I personally can also say that one of the biggest challenges that I had in my life, because I'm a trained composer, arranger, orchestrator, is that, you know, you have all those rules and then you write, and basically you have all those rules that you put into your music. The biggest challenge is to get away of those rules and write your own stuff. So just wanna this is one of the most impressive, I mean, for me also, like, wow, stories.
That's very telling, a way of breaking free of these categories, mm-hmm. and letting yourself express whatever's in there without questioning what it is exactly that you're doing. Yes, I love stories about Stravinsky. That's a fantastic one. Thank you for sharing that.
No, you're welcome.
Well, we need to move on and find some music to share from some of the other artists that were important in your life. Perhaps it's now a good time to talk about Jesse Norman.
Yes, I mean, it's a whole different kind of relationship. It really basically came by accident. I recall that I wanted to... I didn't know her at all. And I was trying to get in touch with her through her agent because we wanted to give her a Lifetime Achievement Award with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. Long story short, I mean, she left her agent and then basically she hired a personal assistant. And I was put in contact with her personal assistant, who is also her attorney. And we just hit it off. And it was really, you know, it's Jesse Norman, an amazing, amazing singer. And it was an amazing, event. She came down there. We kept contact. I'm still in contact with her personal assistant. And we are, you know, it's been a while since we spoke, but we're still pretty close. So that was kind of the friendship that started up. She just invited, I mean, she wrote her autobiography. I think it's going to be launched later this month, which is called Stand Up and Sing.
She always strikes me as such a calm, kind person. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the really great artists share a certain accessibility. You think of great virtuosos as being eccentric and full of weird demands, but a lot of the great players, I think Emmanuel Ax and mm-hmm. Yo-Yo Ma and Jesse Norman have... are truly delightful people to work with.
That is true. I mean, what you really see in a lot of artists that really took a long time to make it, who really clearly know where they're coming from, where they're going to, and how hard the path is, they're very normal people, you know. And unfortunately, the high-maintenance people or really the... There are always exceptions, but, you know, the really high-maintenance, difficult people, sometimes you'll be seeing it's kind of the stars of one day, you know, they just appear and then they disappear again. I think that the path to success and the path to recognition really really forms your character and thinking about it. I also clearly see with those colleagues, musicians, friends, that they're also very willing to help a younger generation to get there because they realize how difficult it has been for themselves. All the power, when you look at Marvin Hamlisch, when you look at Burt Bacharach, and then look at Jesse Norman, Michel Legrand, all those people, they're very successful, but they were not always successful. When you look at their careers, it's struggle for life, really.
I'm speaking with Executive Director of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, Peter Gistelink, who is new to Kalamazoo. This is his first week in the offices at the KSO, and you'll all get to know him better certainly next season when the Kalamazoo starts. I'm not sure which number this is. 74? 94? That's
season.
Nikki, yeah. In the corner. Thank you, Nikki. 94th season starting next September. We're going to take a short break and listen to a couple of songs by Richard Strauss, sung here by Jesse Norman. She is accompanied by pianist Jeffrey Parsons. Two songs of Richard Strauss. We heard Ständchen, Opus 17, number 2, and the song Opus 56, number 4, Mit deinen blauen Augen. Jesse Norman was the soprano, of course. Jeffrey Parsons, the pianist. And you're listening to WMUK at 102.1 FM, Music, NPR, Local Arts and News from Western Michigan University. And if you've just tuned in, my special guest today is the new executive director of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, Peter Gistelink. And we've been going through some incredible theory of music, a little bit of your history, growing up with a very musical family, where the difference between classical and jazz was completely blurred out. It didn't really mean anything, and how that has influenced your worldview in music. And, you know, that's a hint as to what it might bring to the Kalamazoo community and your directorship of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra. Let's have a look at another one of your colleagues, your close friends, who recently passed away, Marvin Hamlisch, who again is an artist who crosses paths without seeming to notice them at all.
Yes, I mean, our friendship really started at the moment when I was working for the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, and it was actually very straightforward. It was just... I always had already an extreme admiration for what he had done, what he had written, his career path. I mean, there is a huge, I don't know if you saw, but there is a huge, fabulous documentary about his life on PBS, PBS documentary.
Great performances series or the Master series.
It's called Marvin Hamlisch, The Way He Was. It's an amazing documentary. Really, really should look at it. Can really recommend it. But it really, he was a very straight shooter, very straightforward person. And my first contact with him was, look, why don't I give him a phone call and ask him if he wants to come to my orchestra, you know? And sometimes the simplest way he works the best. And I don't recall who gave me his number. I mean, yes, I got it from his manager, Andrew Grossman at Columbia Artists in New York. And... called him up and picked up the phone. I mean, I know this sounds really kind of corny or kind of like, but it was really true. It was like, Marvin. And I just put it out there. And it's very... and I found out afterwards, he's on the phone. He can be really taken off guard because he's very short and very sharp, extremely short on phone calls. He Just, okay, I said, look, I would like to invite you, I would like to honor you, give you the Lifetime Achievement Award at Chamber of Philadelphia, blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's great. What is the date? You know, okay, this is the date. Okay, let me know, I'll be there, give me a call next week. And that was it. Okay, have a great day, boom. And really, did he accept? And that was the start. And I recall, I don't have anything in writing. Is he going to show up? I mean, you know, what is this? You know, I called him back the week after just to make sure, yeah, they're all set. Then we met in New York to go over the whole program. And I recall I called him another time. And then he said, Peter, I give you my word. I'll be there. You know, he's really old school, like, handshake contract, you know, handshake agreement.
Wow.
And he did an amazing job. I mean, when you see his connections with, he's how he grew up. I mean, he was the piano player for Barbra Streisand in Funny Girl. And then he...
Someone told me he is the last in the line that goes from Gershwin and Joplin through the American songbook.
Really amazing. He went to, I don't know which tier of school, but he was in the same class as Liza Minnelli. And then Liza Minnelli asked him to play for the birthday party of her mom, Judy Garland. So, I mean, you know, all this kind of connection. She said, whoa. And it's very, he's a very, once again, what we basically are talking of a little bit off air, very simple person, very accessible, extremely helpful. I recall he came to the hotel and just out of respect, you know, say, Mr. Hamish, how are you? Call me Marvin, you know. And I wanted to take his bags. I can do this myself. I've done this myself my whole life, you know. And very straightforward. And something grew there. And out of respect, and, you know, he was so helpful to my previous orchestra. We did the whole fundraiser. He didn't charge me a dime. He was there. We gave him the award. He gave a 30-minute performance, him on the piano, which was an intimate performance of about 250 people. He did it for me as a fundraiser. And I will never, ever forget that, because it was the beginning of a friendship. He didn't really know me. He didn't have to do it for me either. Why did he do it? You know, he really wanted to be helpful. And it's bittersweet, because I always kept in my mind, if there is an opportunity, I really want to do something back for him, because he really helped me out so much. And at some point, Philadelphia Pops, with Peter Nero conducting, Peter Nero was retiring, and the chairman of the board of directors called me and said, look, Peter, we really have a problem. Peter Nero is retiring, and do you know anybody who could do this? I said, look, have you ever thought of Marvin Hamlisch? Really? And I said, look, do you want me to call him right now? So I called his cell phone. And they met the next week, and unfortunately, I mean, the agreement was signed for him to become the next music director of the Philadelphia Pops. Unfortunately, 2 weeks before he passed away, and that's the end of it. So it's a very sad story, but I will always keep him in my mind and in my heart.
Again, a lot of artists can almost hide behind their representatives, their agents, and you can go back and forth. I mean, I know just from arranging interviews that it can be hard to nail down an artist just to even have a 15-minute mm-hmm. phone conversation with. And that story tells me a lot about the kind of man he was. He was his own representative.
But also, once again, what you clearly see, when you look at his career and how his father came, I think it was Germany, it was Austria or Germany, anyway, it doesn't matter, but, you know, because of the Second World War, and Marvin Hamlisch is a Jewish family, because they could escape, they came to the United States. But if you look at his life, where he started, I mean, it was tough. It was really tough in a little small apartment with the whole family and a piano in the middle of it. And he worked very hard. He probably had also some luck, because let's face it, you always have to be a little bit luck in life too. But he's a completely self-made man, became extremely successful, but never forgot where he came from.
I would like to pick out a couple pieces of Marvin Hamlisch that came to my attention very late in his career. It was one of his last film projects, a film, small film, Steven Soderbergh, called The Informant. And for public radio fans, the story of the film actually was drawn from a story on This American Life. Marvin Hamlisch did the music for this and will make you smile the whole time, but you also hear extreme vitality in his playing and extreme tenderness in this slow piece that we'll start with called Trust Me. Well, we're enjoying some music by Marvin Hamlisch, originally for his score, The Informant. Here with executive director of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, Peter Gistelink, who is just starting this week. And you'll all see him next season introducing Kalamazoo Symphony events during the season, which gets started in September, Saturday, September 20th, actually.
Correct.
And full information already is online at kalamazoosymphony.com. Thank you for sharing your stories about these wonderful musicians. It always helps deepen the music. I think you can over-talk music, probably, as Stravinsky would say.
Just play it.
But the thing I find wonderful is the when you talk about music, it becomes even more accessible. You really don't have to think of it as something only highly, highly trained people can do. And that's what we do here on WMUK, is talk with people at the heart of the music, who every time I meet them, you hear stories about passion and love and worthwhile, and it makes sense to support that and to be part of it and to enjoy it at any level. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the present and what you can do as, in your position as executive director. I mean, of course, I'd rather not talk about the financial aspect. That's not that fun, but it's an important part of what you do.
Funding is a very important part.
Very important
it's,
part.
It's actually, I think it's fun. But I mean,
you think it's fun?
I like fundraising, and I like, because it's for a good organization, it's for a good cause. And it's because, you know, when I'm very excited about this position and about the possibilities that this orchestra has and the impact that it has on the community. And let's not forget, probably not a lot of people talk about it, but that the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, especially in the arts world on a national level, has an amazing reputation. Also for its impact on all the schools and the education programs and everything what this orchestra has done. And I don't need to repeat the history, but it has an amazing history also. I mean, founder Lita Snow, and then the relationship to the League of American Orchestras. It's an amazing orchestra. And yeah, I'm very happy to be here. I mean, I applied for the job in October when it became available. I knew of the of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra. I knew of Raymond Harvey, who, by the way, is an amazing music director. I mean, I've got obviously very, very already in-depth conversations, because let's face it, I mean, I want to jump on it right away. You you can have an amazing music director, you can have an amazing executive director, but when they don't get along, it doesn't work. And it's like a marriage, you know, you can have two great people. When they don't get along, they don't get along. So that really clicked well. I have a huge respect for what he does, his programming, his vision on things, and we work very well together. But coming back to the orchestra, I'm very excited to be here because it's with everything, the whole history, and I think that I'm capable to bring Kalamazoo into the next step, you know, to in the next phase of its career, towards his 100th anniversary. So that's something that I really want to work on.
What is our next step? We're a small town. We have, maybe to outsiders, a silly name, which I love, but...
It's a great name, yeah.
We are using our resources every day to get the art we can done. What can we do?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that can be done, that will have a huge positive impact on the orchestra and on the community, is put the orchestra and everything what it does on the map. And what does that mean? That means through new media, putting all the things out there. I mean, we have so many... I had a program within my previous orchestra which we called Creating Audiences Beyond the Concert Hall. Because our traditional way of thinking is we play concerts, we try to get people in the hall, which is obviously extremely important, and we want to fill the seats and there it ends. No, it doesn't. With the chamber orchestra, things that we've done very successfully, we created a huge alliance with Naxos, but straight with Naxos in Hong Kong, with Klaus Hyman, the founder, who I've got a very good business relationship with more than 20 years. But the bottom line is that we have about 100 albums that we've turned every concert into a virtual album, which is available on more than 50 different web providers. The bottom line is in 1 year, with an average availability about 66 albums, we had 85,000 people who paid for downloads and streaming out of 52 countries. So you basically can create buzz, you can about the orchestra, you can, and that really is very important. Why? Because when you create buzz on a global level or international or even a national level, it always comes back to your own community in a very positive way, and it helps your orchestra in your own community.
That's huge.
Yeah,
and that really is something we could do.
And that is one of, and you know what? It's a lot of work, but you don't have to physically displace your musicians. I mean, it's a way of touring without traveling, basically.
Wow. Well, details on the season are at KalamazooSymphony.com, which is a site that may be changing one of these days, sounds like. We are near the very end of this hour, and I need to think of something to play us out with, and... I really ask you for any final thoughts. This has been a really, really pleasurable hour getting to know you.
My final thoughts for this hour, I mean, it's, once again, I already said it, I'm extremely excited. I applied for this position in October. I was lucky to be offered the position. I just started 48 hours ago, basically. I'm going to the usual motions of, you know, getting to know everybody, but I'm taking this on with a lot of pride, with a lot of effort, with a lot of excitement, and I'm very determined to bring this orchestra to the next step, and I'm very happy to be here.
Well, Kalamazooans, I hope you will be very welcoming to Peter Gistelink when you see him on the street or if you see him at a Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra function. And I'm sure that I'll find opportunities to have you back here at WMUK. Thank you very much and welcome to Kalamazoo.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Let's listen to Brandon Ridenour, one of the first soloists of the season, Kalamazoo native, playing with his ensemble, the Canadian Brass. This is one of his own arrangements of Gershwin's song, and Brandon will appear with the KSO on September 20th to start the season. Full details at KalamazooSymphony.com.